Good morning, and welcome to week two. I hope this microphone doesn't make things fuzzier. It feels like it does. Yeah, it does. I don't have much of a choice, unfortunately. This is what we got. I don't know how many, sorry. There is a buzz to it, yeah. So, I don't know how many weeks we're going to be in this group due to the construction upstairs. So, for all I know, this is what we have for the next 5 weeks.
Next, we'll move to a big stadium.
Stadium next. No, I don't like stadium seating. It doesn't look well. Bad for discussions. Okay, so we are here for Life After Death Week 2. Last week, I sent out a summary when I sent out a follow-up email. We made an argument that Judaism believes in life after death based on... this mic is not going to work for me, but we're going to try. Based on the fact that when the Torah presents the account of creation, it has the creation of the body and the injection into the body of the soul, something that isn't found regarding creation of plants, fish, birds, animals. I'm going to try without the mic and just see if we can do it. Okay, so when you hold it farther away, it doesn't really work. Is it okay like this? Okay, then we'll try like this. Fine. So number one, the Torah's account of the creation of human beings differs from the creation of the birds, the fish, the animals, in terms of the injection of this soul, as well as the language of Tzelem Elohim, that the human being is created in the special image of God. And so that indicates that the soul and the body are fundamentally different, and that even if the body perishes, the soul may persist. I'm going to try without and just see how it goes. There we go. That's the weakness. When you're an Orthodox rabbi, you're not used to speaking on Saturdays with a microphone. You don't have the training. You don't have the experience. I don't know. What are the odds that that would work? Okay, thank you. So, what I want to do this week is pursue two other points that I believe demonstrate a Jewish belief in life after death. Number one will be based on the Torah's goals for life. How does the Torah articulate the purpose of life as well as the purpose of death? And then after that, looking at proof from the biblical text itself, which I think indicates a belief in life after death. But let's start with the definition of and purpose of life, and the question of why we live at all. So, let's start with the question. Why does God create life?
To multiply.
So that there will be more life. So that we will multiply? I think we need something better than that, right? You can't just say, well, God creates life so that there will be life. Yes.
You mean human life.
I'm talking human life, correct.
To take care of the earth.
To take care of the earth. Why have an earth? Right, why? Think about it. Meaning, if Judaism believes, as I think, that there is life after death, that the soul is in fact to go on for a very long time after the body ceases to exist, then, really, why be here at all?
Good question.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. Yes, Ruchama.
I think that God needs it.
God
needs Wilson. He's a link between them two. What? He needs a human.
So Ruchama floats the idea that God has a need for there to be human beings. That is a huge Pandora's box. Because, generally speaking, the traditional view of God is that God doesn't need anything. God doesn't eat, God doesn't sleep, God doesn't die, God doesn't get lonely. That's the normal way of looking at God, is that all the personality traits that we associate with God come from our experience of God, the way it feels on our end. not from God ever telling us anything about, you know, himself, herself, itself, whatever term you want to throw on God. Gender is irrelevant. Yes.
Okay. So there's no switch on. So I can't switch it off. But
okay. Thank you. This is better. Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much. So again, we're stuck. Why should there be life? And if life matters, then why is there death? If life has a purpose, then why end it? Yeah, Judith, you were gonna say. So Judith posits curiosity on the part of God. The problem is that if the Torah generally presents God as omniscient, curiosity, I don't even know what curiosity would mean for somebody who's omniscient. So I'm still stuck. I can go in the order of three hands that I see now and then go further, even though I can ask you more hands at it, but just because otherwise it won't get anywhere. Yes? Yes? What's your name?
Jack. Because man is created in God's image. God wants man to give proof of himself or herself. And thus, to engage in improvements and then do business to help other humans.
So there is a reason to create life so that life will improve itself. Why not just make us in the new and improved form? No, I'm serious. There's value in the struggle itself. So I'm going to come back to that idea. This was the second hand that I saw. Yeah.
God already created the earth and the animals, correct?
Right.
So I think that in his mind he wants to make a better place. And to do that, he created a human being who thinks differently, does good for the world, and the chapters of their lives, he grows and expands their life and has children. So that life, not that one person will live forever, but that Lord exists.
Right.
So he can get children fruitful and do good in the world.
So that's a refreshing thought. Because I have to say, every day I turn on the radio or I read news articles, and I find out that human beings are bad for the earth. This is a different perspective. Human beings are good for the planet. Go us.
That's not all human beings are bad.
Not all human beings are bad for the planet. So the only problem I have again is then why are we a planet? It just pushes the question back a step. Yes, the last hand on this, Susan.
We've been talking a lot about where we have to worship God.
Who's saying our worship? I haven't mentioned worship yet. I've talked for.
No, you had to worship God.
Okay. Yeah.
And what we say to God, we do all of this, a big part of it is our honoring God, our praying to God, our recognizing God's value in our life.
So that's an interesting point. Susan raises a point which we're going to see, I think, in one of the sources that I have on the sheet. There is a secular writer who's going to suggest that, from a Jewish perspective, the point of human beings is to praise God. But honestly, that's not supported in the sources. Yes, it's something we do, but to articulate that as the purpose of our existence doesn't seem to fit the sources, as you'll see. So I'm going to go further. I know there are more hints and more ideas, and as I said last week, we have a large enough group that we can't possibly pull everyone, although it would make for a better experience if we could. I would like to suggest, based on the biblical verses of creation, going right back to the creation story, that the goal of creating human life is to put the ethical imperative ahead of the instinct for pleasure. For human beings to learn, and this goes back to the growth process that Jack mentioned, for human beings to learn to put what they ought to do ahead of what feels good, ahead of what they want to do.
There are a lot of different answers within Jewish tradition for why we are created. There's one classic response, which I think is very interesting, which I'll just mention because I don't want to address the topic without mentioning this. It's an interesting philosophical idea that God is, by definition, beneficent. God, by definition, is, we call it Hebrew, metiv, one who provides good. You cannot provide good unless there is someone to receive it. Not so much an articulation of need, like God needs to give, and therefore God needs there to be a recipient, as just by definition. If God, by definition, is a giver, then there must be someone to receive it. So I find that an interesting idea, but I'm not really going into that. I'm just mentioning it because it's an important idea, I think, and it's an interesting one. But what I'm about to articulate is heavily influenced by a book, which I find to be very good, and would suggest if anyone wants further reading on this topic. It's called The Emergence of Ethical Man by Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik. You can see the title in source number 3. I've quoted it off and on in our classes over the years. I just think it's really, really good. He says what I said, that the goal of life is for us to learn to put ethical purpose ahead of pleasure. You see, we noted last week that the language of the biblical text when it describes the creation of human beings is fundamentally the same as the language used in creating animals and even plants. We're all brought forth from dirt from the ground. The same expressions are used for the forming. The same language of bear fruit and multiply is used for all of these creatures across the system. However, God does something interesting with human beings that he doesn't do with the other creatures. He makes human beings aware of their behavior, including their instinctive behavior, and of themselves. Take a look at the sheep, please. Source number 1. I brought you first God's statement to the animals to bear fruit and multiply, and then God's statement to the human being to bear fruit and multiply. What's the difference between the two? Don't get caught up on the water versus the land. That's not germane. There's more to the verses that, you know, afterwards in terms of the space they occupy. But what's the difference between the command to bear fruit and multiply given to the animals and given to the human beings? Yeah?
Because it says they'll make a great nation out of you.
No. In the verses in number 1. And great nation is said regarding the Jews. We're not human beings. We're all the human race. Yeah. Right. In both cases, it's a blessing. Okay? In both cases, it's a blessing. You may not feel like necessarily your children are a blessing yet, but, you know, somehow or other, it's a blessing. But in the second one, it says God blessed them and God told them. He informs them of procreation. That's number 1. Number 2. Take a look at source number 2. The instructions regarding the diet of animals and the diet of human beings. I noted last week that human beings are vegetarian at the start of the Torah. Here you see the verses. Regarding the animals, it says, and God said to them, I'm sorry, the first one is the one to the human being. This whole passage is God speaking to the human beings. And God said to them, he says to Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, behold, I have given you all the seed-bearing grasses across the earth, and all the fruit-bearing, seed-bearing trees. They will be for you to eat. And I give to all the beasts of the land, all the birds of the heavens, and all the cattle on the land which lives, all of the grasses to eat. And it was so. Description first of what God has given to human beings. Description second of what God has given to the animals. Fundamental difference, as pointed out by Rabbi Soloveitchik, is the human being is told what the diet is going to be. The animals aren't informed of it, simply so. They enter into the world and they eat what they eat. Human beings are actually told. We're dealing here with the most fundamentally instinctive behavior in number one, procreation, and in number two, eating. And in both of those cases, the animal is simply given something. There's no dialogue, there's no conversation, there's no awareness. Whereas the human being is informed of it. God tells the human being. And as our salvation sees it, and that's number three, this awareness is built into being what we called last week, Tselem Elohim, the image of God. He says, Tselem, this image, signifies man's awareness of himself as a biological being and the state of being informed of his natural drives. So, at the start of creation, human beings are not only created with certain powers, but they are told, here is your basic nature. You eat, you produce children. Now that human being is aware of what he does, what she does, the human being can now receive a new type of information, which is ethical instruction. Amen. And that suggests that even in the course of telling human beings about instinctive behavior, once you have instructions, you will eat this, that means you won't eat that. That means that you're going to have to make certain decisions, and those decisions will be informed particularly by what comes next. If you look at number four, this is exactly what you're talking about, I think. In Genesis chapter 2, God commanded upon the man, saying, from every tree in the garden you shall eat. And of course you know what comes next. And from this other tree you shall not eat. Yeah. Jack, you're asking a question? No? Okay, Stephen.
So all this shows is that Hashem has a personal relationship with Adam and Hawa.
So that is one element of what it's shown, is direct communication connotes a relationship, I agree with you. But that's not all that you're seeing here. It's not only about that, it's also an empowerment. When you're being told not only do you exist, that you have things to do, and you have instructions. Eat this, and not that. Even the language that is used in number four, the verse begins by itself. Vayetzav, my Hebrew speakers. What word in Hebrew is associated with Vayetzav, a very common word? Mitzvah, thank you. Vayetzav is a command. Mitzvah is a command. The message here is that it isn't just going to be God telling you this is the state of things, but it's going to be God commanding you this is what you shall do. And at that point, you get what our salvation puts in source number five. God takes man-animal. Man-animal meaning we're human, but we are in many ways animalistic. At that stage in the Torah's description of creation of human beings, God takes man-animal into his confidence, addresses him, and reveals to him his moral will. Human beings now have been told that there is a moral will. There is a decision of this is good and this is bad. You're a player. You have to make calculation. You have to make a decision to put the moral first. To read. Sorry.
Once a will commanded you, that kind of behavior for me, was the version that if you very much have to make choices.
Yes.
You can't make choices.
Yes. Well, no, you can make choices. You're thinking in a very military way. The read says, once you say commanded, then you don't have choices anymore. But the truth of the matter is, you have a choice to fulfill the command or don't, and the evidence of that is when they go eat from the fruit they weren't supposed to eat from. Right? I wish it were true that when there's a command, that means automatically, therefore certain things will follow, but human experience is not like that. Ricky, and then?
So at what point did man get free choice to make decisions right or wrong? Because this is what is, I understand, the purpose of the soul or the reason for the soul is we're made by making a good choice rather than a bad choice, develop the soul. But we still got free choice because after Adam and Eve were thrown out of Gan Eden.
So free choice seems to be inherent in who we are. First of all, I would move away from an expression of why you're given a soul, because as we said last week, you are a combination of the soul and the body. This is who you are. It's not like you're given something. This is who you are, an inherent in the soul. This Tzelem Elohim, image created by God, is free will. Free will is there from the start. And the most clear expression of this is the fact that they ate from the fruit. If you didn't have free will, how did you end up eating? If you didn't have free will, how could God command you anything? The word command is meaningless unless there is the ability to disobey the command.
But it's also something that God gave us. It's free will.
No, it's part of you. It's who you are, by definition.
And everything that what we are was created.
Yes,
by God.
Yes. But it's there in us from the beginning. This is who we are. It's not something that enters the human being at some point. That's what I'm trying to say. This is our identity, is to have free will, and we have it from the get-go. That's what I'm suggesting. Yes.
If God is all-knowing, then God would know that Eve is going to eat the apple from the tree.
Yep.
And then I begin to wonder, why does God need us at all?
Right.
God is everything.
Right. So in terms of the question of why does God need, and even the word need is an odd word, that's where we're going with this. We're talking about why there's life. Why does God create life? That's what we started with. But in terms of the question of, wait a minute, doesn't God know she's going to do it? The answer is you bet. The basic premise of the entire biblical account, from beginning to end, is that knowing something is going to happen does not mean it's not worth happening. In other words, there's value in the events that take place to the God who knows full well and often predicts exactly what is going to happen. God says to Moses, Moses, you're going to die, and then this nation is going to go worship idols. Well, God, do something about it. Right? Why are you allowing this to happen? And the answer is, evidently, it's valuable for it to play out on full well. I mean, you can make your question a lot stronger and point out that as a general rule, when there's something you don't want to have people eat, you generally don't put it in front of them. This tree is in the middle of the garden. Hey, I have an idea. You're God. Don't create it at all. If you don't want them to eat it, why is it there? Why is it in the middle of the garden? Why is it also very attractive? Like, why didn't you make it an ugly tree with a big skull and crossbones on it? Right? Paint it like, you know, poison green or something. There's more going on in that story in general in terms of the fruit, but it's way not where we're going right now. But I think that there's value in the event that takes place, even with foreknowledge of what's going to happen. So God's warning to human beings is that they should not put pleasure ahead of purpose. And you see it in what happens with that fruit. Take a look, please. It's verse number 6. I already described the fruit to you, but here you see it. And the woman perceived that the tree was good for eating, and that it was desirable for the eyes, and that the tree was good for gazing. And she took its fruit and she ate. And she gave to her husband with her as well. And he ate. Great scene, except, you know, you're not supposed to eat it. But the point is, the fruit is attractive. The fruit is appealing in its beauty. And that's the description of this tree as the tree of knowledge of Tov Vara. So people usually translate Tov Vara as good and bad or good and evil, right? Usually evil. That's usually what you hear people say. The tree of knowledge of good and evil. Rabbi Soloveitchik suggests that that's a mistranslation. It's not good and evil in the moral sense. It's good and bad in the pleasure sense. Because she says, the tree looks good to eat. That's the way that she perceives it, as something that she would enjoy. And the lesson is supposed to be, yes, you would enjoy this, but that doesn't mean you have to do it.
So does it
Yes. It's not just a test. It's a lesson. It's a learning experience. Here is something that you would enjoy, but I'm trying to get you to do things other than because they look like you would enjoy them. That's the idea. Take a look at verse number 7, where I quote by Soloveitchik once again, where he says, yeah, it's really remarkable when you read it. He came over from Europe. English wasn't his first, second, or third language. And then you read this, it's like, what? God forbade man the orgiastic aesthetic experience, the acquisition of a pleasure impulse as imperative. He was not allowed to overemphasize the moment of wantonness making the beauty ideal the fascinating force in human life. You're not supposed to get, have you understood that according to the word? God forbids human beings from following pleasure as the imperative that is going to define what they do. He doesn't want the human being to define his choices based on pleasure. And that's the problem of the sin of eating from fruit. It's an act of effectively treason against the ethical imperative. When you should have been thinking about I ought to do, you were thinking about I want to do. Okay. So what we establish... Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Shelly,
okay.
So what about making someone smile? Making someone laugh?
Huh? What about... Sorry, that's not...
A purpose in life, that's enjoyment.
Maybe. Does all purpose have to be, you know, bitter-tasting medicine? I mean, how many get to the specific one? She asked the question, what about making somebody giggle, smile, you know, something you enjoy, but also is clearly a positive thing to do, and most contexts, not all, like when they're trying to take a passport picture. But the point that you're making pushes us to the next question, which is, okay, God, you want me to understand that I have to put ethical imperative ahead of pleasure, but what is that ethical imperative? What exactly is it that you want me to do? And that's where we have to go next. Yes? So that's where we move now. What exactly is this ethical purpose? And how do we know? I mean, the Torah is filled with commandments, right? You may start with eat from these trees and don't eat from that tree, and then just start motoring your way through the Bible. And consider this. How many mitzvot are there? 613. How to get that number is a fascinating question, but there's a passage in the Talmud that teaches that there are 613 mitzvot. There's a lot of energy invested in a period going roughly from the 9th century to roughly the 14th century by sages trying to figure out what this list of 613 is. Their problem was not that they were falling short of the number. You know, scratching my head. Look at 472. How many do you have? The problem is the other way. There are way more than 613. And the problem was, how do you count these in order to actually cut it down to 613? What is included? What is not included? My point being, you can't possibly tell me that the ethical imperative is each one of these individual commands. Give me something else I can work with. So there's a passage in the Talmud that I think is very helpful in this regard. And I wrote it for you in source number 3. It's based, number 8, sorry. It's based on a passage in Yeshaya and Isaiah, right? It's just the passage itself and the extrapolation to just bring you the guts of the passage of the Talmud. In number 8, the sage Rava. Rava lives, I believe, roughly 5th century Common Era. Rava calls, when a person is brought in for judgment, meaning posthumous judgment, they say to him, the heavenly court is going to ask the following 6 questions. Did you deal honestly That's question number one. In Hebrew, it's nasata velatata be'emuna. To deal with others honestly, faithfully would be a reasonable translation. Second one. Did you establish time for Torah study? Right? We're here. Kavati Kino Torah. Check. You established time for Torah study. Interesting to note. Doesn't ask how much. Right? It doesn't say that you study 12 hours a day. Why not? Why is there no quantum here? Why does it say how much you have to study? Sorry? Supposed to study all day, but you don't establish time. Then you didn't fulfill this. Yes, yeah. Right, what different people can do is different. And the Talmud has a line regarding study, saying one who does a lot, one who does a little, the key is that their focus should be for the sake of heaven, but also because there's value just in having fixed times. There's a difference between the person who is home, they, you know, it's 5, 6, 7 o'clock in the evening, and they pick up a book, and they say, I'm going to read for a little while. And the person who defines their schedule by saying, at 6 o'clock, or whatever time it is, I am going to sit and study. That's my time for study. The difference is, when you orient your schedule around it, that says something about your priorities, and influences the rest of the day, because everything else has to make room for it, right? A person who exercises, right? You know the difference. The difference between saying, I'm going to go for a run when I feel like it, and saying, I go for a run at 6 o'clock every morning when it comes. The difference between the two is that the person who says, I'm going to go for a run when I feel like it, won't. Realistically. That's not the way it works. You set up time and say, this is what matters to me. And so the text is saying, you have to have fixed times. Next one. Did you involve yourself in procreation? And the reason why it asks involve yourself is because, unfortunately, the reality is not everybody is going to succeed. The obligation is not that you have to succeed. The obligation is, did you make the attempt? The next one. Anticipate the Messiah. In Hebrew, Tzivita Yeshua. Did you anticipate salvation? And the idea is that the biblical text is filled with predictions that there will be a redemption of Israel, we will be brought back to our land, we will be led by a Mashiach, an anointed one. And the question is, did you believe in the passages in Tanakh that taught that this is going to happen? Did you have faith, essentially? And then the last two questions are regarding the study of Torah. Did you delve into fine points of wisdom, and did you understand lessons within lessons? Meaning, did you draw insights from the Torah? Did you actually try to grasp deeply what it means? And did you take it seriously, trying to interpret and extrapolate? And then the last line in that passage number 8. And yet with all of this, if he possesses awe of God in his storehouse, he will do well. But otherwise, he will not. Meaning, you can check off all the boxes, but if reverence for God isn't part of it, then this isn't really God's mission at all. This is just what he chose to do. Right? A person who happens to do good things for the sake of personal satisfaction is different from a person who's doing this because they believe this is what God wants them to do. And that's the conclusion of the Talmudic passage. So what I draw from here is that the Talmud is saying, again, based on a verse in Isaiah, that this is what interests God most. Right? These questions are what's going to be asked. Then that must mean that this is our ethical mission. Because otherwise, why are these the things that you're asking of? That must be that this is what God cares about. That would be my hypothesis. Prove me wrong. What's the weakness in saying that? Yeah?
Well, I don't know if this is where you're heading, but I have a problem understanding why God created people that are great people and good people and giving people that don't believe in God.
I thought it was a matter of choice.
No, but we're saying that they wouldn't possess the ability to be accepted as good in their final judgment, because you know, if we believe in what we just reviewed here.
Yeah. So the question is, if you're going to tell me that reverence is so critical, why would God create people who are good, who are great, who don't believe? And my answer would be, belief is their choice. It's up to them.
I appreciate that. But it's also saying they wouldn't get a good judgment, conceptually.
Just like anybody.
We're supposed to believe that, is what I'm saying. Right,
no, that's what the text is saying. Now, I will note that the text, in general, working within the Talmud, has a recognition that there are people who are exempt from responsibility because they're not exposed to whatever influence would have been necessary. So the Talmud discusses, for example, if you have a Jewish kid who is adopted as a small child and raised by, you know, bandits somewhere, you can't hold him responsible for the fact that he never observed Shabbat. You didn't know what Shabbat was. You're not responsible for that which you never exposed to. But the person who was exposed to it is responsible to absorb it. I think that is part of this. Sorry? I'm not saying that doing good can't be pleasant, can't bring pleasure. But I'm saying that when you have a choice between doing good and not, and pleasure is on the side of not, to choose to do good instead. But yes, sometimes doing good will bring pleasure. But you can make the argument that this list is ridiculously incomplete. Because I mentioned 613 mitzvot. Think of some of the more prominent ones. Shabbat is not on here. Man is on here. I'll come back to it. But Shabbat is not on here. We think that matters. Kosher is not on here. It's not on the six questions that you're going to be asked. It's a very odd thing. Susan asks, what about all of the mitzvot that we call Bein Adam LaChaverot? Social mitzvot, things you do for other people. So I happen to think that in some sense they are. The idea of procreation in its most basic form is chesed, is generosity, creating life and providing for it. I would view that as the beginning of social assistance for others, but you're right. There's no explicit mention of kindness for others. So when I look at it, and I brought you a passage from the Talmud that does this in number 9, there's a passage in the Talmud which points out that different prophets condensed the Torah. So Micha is one of those. Micha narrows down the Torah. He says, what does God want of you other than the following? Asok mishpat, practice justice. It's not in there. I didn't bring the translation of his. I should have. He said the three principles are performing justice, ava hesed, loving acts of kindness for others, and hasnei alav hesed elokeha, walking humbly with God. Those are his three. Nice. You know, other than maybe saying mishpat, justice fits with dealing honestly with others, the other two elements aren't really on this list. Isaiah says, guard justice and act righteously. The prophet Amos, seek me, God, and live. To which that's challenged, and then Habakkuk is quoted, another prophet saying, to live by your faith. My point in bringing this is to suggest that we're not meant to take the list of six as all consuming, and that's all that matters. But rather, it's attempting to digest the Torah's certain key principles, from which you can extrapolate the rest. There certainly are other values. I bring you two quotes here that are very important, at least important to me. Take a look at sources 10 and 11. I've used them in other classes. Perhaps some of you have been there. One comes from Rabbi Yerucham Lubavitch, who was a lead educator in the Mir Yeshiva about 120 years ago. The other from Rabbi Yitzchak Avolozhin, quoting his father, Rabbi Chaim Avolozhin, chief student of Vilna Gaon at the end of the 18th century. Both of them, very, very serious intellects, functioning within academies where the environment was devoted to intellectual study. But look at what they each have to say about the purpose of existence. Rabbi Lubavitch talks about what's called in Hebrew, Nosei Ba'ol in Chavero, bearing the yoke with others, bearing the burdens of others. He says, the issue of bearing the yoke with others is so great because this is the entire Torah, the joining of souls to feel each other's feelings, what we call empathy. All of the Torah study, all of the learning and all the deeds, the final goal is that all souls should be joined to feel each other's feelings. He says that's the goal of existence, is empathy. And everything else is just in order to get us there. Rabbi Chaim of the Legends, his son quotes him, my father always used to rebuke me as he saw that I would not experience the pain of others. This is what he always told me. This is a person's entire purpose. A person is not created for himself. A person is created only to benefit others with whatever power is in his possession. It's a very important statement, I think. And it's not really expressed clearly on this list of six. Yes? If you have this list, which is so Jewish-focused, what happens to people who are not part of Judaism? It shakes up the question that Lisa asked before, right? Meaning, what about someone who's very good and does things that are not, isn't Jewish and doesn't have this reverence for the Jewish God that we mentioned earlier. So we are going to talk about that more when we actually talk about the Garden of Eden, Gehenna, and the like. What is the place for Jews versus non-Jews? The brief answer is that Talmud makes it very clear that non-Jews get in also. It's, there's more to be discussed, but that's the short answer. What I'm trying to draw from here, what I see here in these sources, is you have on the one hand a list of six questions the person is going to be asked that seem to highlight the importance of certain aspects of Judaism. Having a trustworthy attitude towards others and interacting with others in a way that one is going to be honest and above board with others. The idea of making God and God's Torah the focus so that one establishes time for study, creating life, benefiting others, believe in Tanakh and in its predictions, throwing insights from Torah study, these articulate for us a mission which involves activities that may well involve pleasure. We mentioned the intellectual pleasure of study. They may well involve pleasure, but they're fundamentally an ethical imperative, which involves duties towards this world, and meeting other human beings, and the world we have in general, as well as ourselves. Some of this is about ourselves, our own growth, right? The idea of my commitment to study of Torah and to extrapolating and learning from it is about myself, as opposed to dealing honestly with others or creating life, which is about my duty to other people. The overall goal here is to prioritize the needs of others ethically, as well as my own growth over pleasure.
But now I come to the next piece of this, which is, okay,
this sounds like a lot, right? There's a lot here in terms of what we're supposed to do in life. If so, why have that? Right? Like, you give me such a short period of time to get this stuff done. Why not have older life?
Why is it that it has to end at all? So, looking at the time and realizing that we have a lot to cover here, I'm gonna
talk a little bit here rather than open up that question. Some suggest that death is a spiritual asset that is meant to benefit us in our lives or to benefit our souls. Benefiting life means if bodies didn't die, with devotion of time and energy to these different pursuits be meaningful? If a person lives forever, would the time and energy we devote to anything be meaningful? When you have an infinite supply of something, then that which you spend on anything doesn't take away from what you have. And now it becomes less meaningful. You follow? I mean, this isn't the, what's called the Hebrew Kiddush. This isn't the novelty. I think people generally come to this conclusion at some point that if you have an infinite resource, then that which you choose to spend doesn't really have meaning. Effectively, what that means is that death transforms life from being pleasant but meaningless to being painful but meaningful. That's what it does. And I stress that also because of the different ways in which death impacts life. Death is not only the point where the person's body stops breathing, or heart beating, or brain functioning, whatever your definition of death, that's definitely a different class. The point is, death affects everything. It affects the way we live. It affects our decisions about what to act. It creates disease. It creates fear of infirmity and anxiety about what's going to go wrong tomorrow. It creates pain in terms of our relationships with others. It affects everything. So that it injects into life simultaneously meaning and pain. That's the way it is. And that's one way to look at why human beings die. To create meaning for life. More than that, though, it's considered to have a religious benefit. The rabbis in the Midrash noted that there are various times in human history when human beings have claimed to be gods or godlike, right? Like the ancient pharaohs. So when you create death, that effectively shows that human beings are not gods. Because if they were, they wouldn't be mortal. That's a second idea. A third idea is that actually it benefits the soul in a remarkable way. Look at the Midrash of Rabbi Yochanan, source number 12. Every day of creation, except Tuesday, the Torah says that God looked at the world and it was good. Right? Tuesday or Monday? Tuesday is the one that God says. God doesn't like Tuesday. He's okay with Mondays. Sorry? I thought Tuesday was good twice. Yeah. Tuesday was good twice. Yeah. Tuesday was double. Yeah, that's what we're thinking of. Okay. God's okay with Tuesdays. Just like God's Tuesdays. We made it through Monday. This is good. But there's one day for which God says, behold, it was very good. Right? One day is very good, and that's, of course, day six. What does that mean, that day? Very good? All sorts of answers, of course. But take a look at this Midrash number 12. They found it recorded in Rabbi Meir's teachings. Behold, it was very good. That refers to death. What in the world are you talking about? Why is that very good? So some suggest the following approach. That the body, we said last week, is fundamentally animal. It's very this world. But the soul doesn't belong here. And And so there has to be a point where the soul is liberated from the body to be able to act with its full powers. As long as the soul is inside the body, it has limitations because of the desires of the body, because of the needs of the body. The goal of death is to liberate the neshama, to liberate the soul. And according to this, human beings were always meant to be mortal. There was never any idea that human beings were going to live forever, because that would just mean that the soul is encumbered forever. Take a look at source number 13. Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra makes this statement. He says, there is one ruach. Ruach is part of the soul. We mentioned it last week. For man and beast, with which he lives and feels in this world, and as one dies, so the other dies, man dies, beast dies, other than a higher portion which a human has beyond that of the beast. One of the Greek doctors already brought complete proofs for this, that it is not possible for human life to be unlimited. It is inherent in being human that people are going to die. Why? So that the soul can have its day. And that's another approach to why human beings are going to perish. There's another view Nachmanides has. He believes that it's actually a punishment, but I'm not going to go there. Not because it's not interesting, but because there's too much else to talk about. Nachmanides is going to have to wait for another class. But the point is this. In none of these explanations that Judaism offers for why somebody would have to die, whether we view death as liberation of the soul, whether we view death as something which prevents the deification of human beings, whether we view death as something that makes our activities in life meaningful, whichever way you take it, none of the sources in classic Judaism have taken death as the destruction of the soul. The goal of death may be to assist the soul during life in engaging in meaningful activities. The goal of death may be to assist the soul after life by liberating it. But it's never about destruction of the soul. And so this is what I'm trying to get at for the last 45 plus minutes. It's taken me a little while. But if the goal of life is for the soul to evolve to the point where we put ethical imperatives ahead of pleasure, right? If that's why we are here, going back to my salvation read of the story of creation, if the goal is to fulfill by itself, to fulfill the ethical command, and if death is meant to assist us in that, whether assisting us by giving meaning to our experience in life, or showing liberating the soul from the body, then Judaism has no reason to assume that the soul should die when the body does. There's no reason to assume that the soul should die. And last week we said if the soul is injected into the body separately, its experience is independent of the body, and there's no reason for it to cease when the body ceases. But now we're saying, from a teleological perspective, in terms of what the purpose of existence is, Judaism does not posit an existence in which makes any sense for the soul to stop when the body stops. If the goal of life is this form of growth, to use the term that Jack put on before, and the goal of death is to assist in that growth, why should the experience of dying terminate that growth? You follow what I'm suggesting? It's a philosophical argument. So, not everybody is of a philosophical bent. And I would assume that in a room of this many people, there are probably some people who are saying, okay, what you basically argue are two philosophical reasons to assume that Judaism will believe that the soul outlives the body. But show me something in the Bible. Show me something in Tanakh that says human beings keep on going as a soul when the body stops. That may be more important for some than philosophy. So that is where I wanted to go next. I've got 5 minutes left, but I'm going to use them. And then we'll start on it now, and then we'll pick up with it next week. But you do have to do that. There are those who contend that original Judaism, so to speak, did not believe in an afterlife, or did not believe in an afterlife in the form that it is taught today. They point to things like what my salvation pointed out. That much of the language of creation links human beings with the animals and with the plants. That there are biblical verses that might lead somebody to believe that there's nothing after this world. And it's a logical challenge. The fact that when the Torah talks about reward and punishment, it often talks about this worldly reward and punishment. So you get people like Professor James Tabor in source number 14. He's at the University of North Carolina. In which he says, his essay is called What the Bible Says About Death, Afterlife, and the Future. Okay. He says, first of all, consider the notion of the future of the individual human person. The ancient Hebrews had no idea, he says, of an immortal soul living a full and vital life beyond death, nor any resurrection or return from death. Human beings, like the beasts of the field, are made of dust of the earth, and at death they return to that dust, he quotes verses we've seen. The Hebrew word nephesh, traditionally translated living soul, more properly understood, he claims, as living creature, is the same word used for all breathing creatures and refers to nothing immortal. The same holds true for the expression translated as the breath of life, which we saw last week, Nishmat Chayim. It is physical, animal life. For all practical purposes, he says, death was the end. He quotes a verse from Tehillim, from Psalms, to then go down into silence. They did not participate as the living and praising God, which he thinks was seen as the most vital human activity. Although, as I said before, I disagree. Continuing to this next paragraph, he says, as we move to the period of first Greek and then Roman domination of the Eastern Mediterranean world, the biblical materials reflect drastic development with regard to the view of the future. Two views dominate, the shape of an eschatological transformation of the cosmos, in other words, the idea of a messianic time, and the notion that an immortal soul escapes the body of death to enter the heavenly world. In other words, as far as he is concerned, originally Judaism did not teach life after death. Originally there was an immortal soul, and everything which Judaism is telling you, he says, doesn't fit his vision of the biblical verses. Okay, I can live with somebody disagreeing with me, I'm cool with that. He studiously ignores things like the phrase image of God, right? You notice that? That wasn't there. He has not addressed. He ignores also the fact that the Torah presents breathing into human beings, the breath of life, is only presented for humans and not presented for animals and other creatures. That also doesn't interest him. There's an idea that's a little similar, but somewhat different, in number 15. This is from the website reformjudaism.org by Howard Jaffe, who is a little bit of a plant. He says, Judaism has, from the Torah itself, always spoken of a life following this one. The Torah speaks about what seems to be a physical place called Sheol, to which one, quote, goes down, following this life. A variety of different passages indicate Sheol was probably thought of as located in the center of the earth, although it's not ever formally described. What is clear is that this was a well-known concept among the ancient Israelites. So he has an afterlife, but it doesn't sound particularly fun. It is not until the Pharisees, which he puts as 100 BCE, okay, that the notion of a spiritual life after death developed in any meaningful way in Jewish thought, leading to Olam Haba, da da da. So this is one way to look at it. Or two ways to look at it, right? The one who said there was nothing originally, and the one who said there was Sheol afterwards. So our mission is going to have to be to ask the question, is that true? Does this really reflect what you see in Tanakh? And I'm going to bring you one verse down, it's verse number 16, just as I can't leave you with just that. And then we're going to have to open it up at the beginning of next week's class to really see it. That's going to show you that this picture of Tanakh is not nearly as simple as what those two sources are trying to paint. Take a look at number 16. This is a passage quoting a woman by the name of Abigail. The story of David and Abigail. Basically, in this story, Abigail's husband was a man named Nabal. And Nabal was a very wealthy man. And David was on the run, he was a fugitive, and he and his supporters had taken care of Nabal's animals. And at the end of the season, they came to him and said, you know, we're starving, we could use some help. And Nabal said, I have no interest in helping you whatsoever, you're a pretender to the throne, go away. And David is very angry. And David comes with his posse of men Dunama. And Abigail heads him off and says, I'm going to make this right. Don't worry about it. You guys will be taken care of. And then she gives David a blessing. And this blessing is right here, number 16. She says, if a man rises to pursue you and seek your soul, may my master's soul be bound in the bond of life with Hashem your God. May the souls of your enemies be slung in the bowl of the sling. Now, have you ever heard that phrase? Bound in the bond of life? Then put it on the gravestone. In the heading for number 16, I gave you five Hebrew letters, which you'll often see on a gravestone. They are the acronym for that in Hebrew. It stands for Tia Nishnada Surah and Surah Hayim, that the person's soul should be bound up at the bond of life. It suggests the idea there is this thing called the bond of life that connects souls. And what she is saying to David, living in a society in which Professor Tabor thinks doesn't recognize afterlife, right? What she says to him is, your soul should be bound up in the bond of life with God, and the souls of your enemies should go into some kind of catapult. This is not a this-worldly blessing. This is a blessing for the next one. What this catapult is, we have to come back to. What this bond of life is, we have to come back to as well. But I think it's really hard to read this as being the expression of someone who doesn't believe that things go on afterwards. And this is not a late book, so to speak, in Tanakh coming from slavery. This is a book of Samuel, which puts it pretty early. We'll talk more about that next week. We have a lot to see, obviously, in terms of this. If you flip the page, you see we have a lot more verses to look at. But what I want to make sure is clear is we spent the bulk of the time today on a second philosophical argument. An argument that, if you believe that life is for the purpose of us learning to be ethical and learning not to make decisions based on pleasure, that's what's supposed to happen. And death is meant to liberate the soul from its bond with the body. There's no reason to assume that that's where the soul falls. And number two, the second point that we just spent the last, 10 to 15 minutes on, that you can actually find references to this in the biblical text, and we'll have to come back to that, God willing, next week. Thank you very much. Oh, I have